Chapter 104. To an English Admirer. Innocence at Home, Reading, Connecticut, August 15, 08. Dear Sir, I highly prize the pipes, and shall intimate to people that Raleigh smoked them, and doubtless he did. After a little practice I shall be able to go further, and say he did. They will then be the most interesting features of my library's decorations. The horseshoe is attracting a good deal of attention, because I have intimated that the conqueror's horse cast it. It will attract more when I get my hand in and say he cast it. I thank you for the pipes and the shoe, and also for the official guide, which I read through at a single sitting. If a person should say that about a book of mine, I should regard it as good evidence of the book's interest. Very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. In his philosophy, What Is Man?, and now and again in his other writings, we find Mark Twain giving small credit to the human mind as an originator of ideas. The most original writer of his time, he took no credit for pure invention, and allowed none to others. The mind, he declared, adapted, consciously or unconsciously. It did not create. In a letter which follows he elucidates this doctrine. The reference in it to the apton, and to the kerosene, as the reader may remember, have to do with Captain Hurricane Jones, and his theory of the miracles of Sok, and of the prophets of Baal, as expounded in some rambling notes of an idle excursion. By a trick of memory Clemens gives the little duke as his suggestion for the prince and the pauper. He should have written the prince and the page, by the same author. To Rev. F. Why Christ, in New York. Reading, Con. August, 08. Dear Sir, you say often owe my best sermons to a suggestion received in reading, or from other exterior sources. Your remark is not quite in accordance with the facts. We must change it to owe all my thoughts, sermons and ideas to suggestions received from sources outside of myself. The simplified English of this proposition is, oh, man's brains ever originated an idea. It is an astonishing thing that after all these ages the world goes on thinking the human brain machinery can originate a thought. It can't. It never has done it. In all cases, little and big, the thought is born of a suggestion, and in all cases the suggestions come to the brain from the outside. The brain never acts except from exterior impulse. A man can satisfy himself of the truth of this by a single process. Let him examine every idea that occurs to him in an hour, a day, in a week, in a lifetime if he please. He will always find that an outside something suggested the thought, something which he saw with his eyes, or heard with his ears, or perceived by his touch, not necessarily today, nor yesterday, nor last year, nor 20 years ago, but sometime or other. Usually the source of the suggestion is immediately traceable, but sometimes it isn't. However, if you will examine every thought that occurs to you for the next 2 days, you will find that in at least 9 cases out of 10 you can put your finger on the outside suggestion, and that ought to convince you that number 10 had that source too, although you cannot at present hunt it down and find it. The idea of writing to me would have had to wait a long time if it waited until your brain originated it. It was born of an outside suggestion, Sir Thomas and my old captain. The hypnotist thinks he has invented a new thing, suggestion. This is very sad. I don't know where my captain got his kerosene idea. It was 41 years ago, and he is long ago dead. But I know that it didn't originate in his head, but it was born from a suggestion from the outside. Yesterday a guest said, how did you come to think of writing The Prince and the Pauper? Apostrophe I didn't. The thought came to me from the outside, suggested by that pleasant and picturesque little history book, Charlotte M. Yonge's Idle Duke. I doubt if Mrs. Burnett knows whence came to her the suggestion to write Idle Lord Fauntleroy, but I know it came to her from reading The Prince and the Pauper. In all my life I have never originated an idea, and neither has she, nor anybody else. Man's mind is a clever machine, and can work up materials into ingenious fancies and ideas, but it can't create the material. None but the gods can do that. In Sweden I saw a vast machine receive a block of wood, and turn it into marketable matches in 2 minutes. It could do everything but make the wood. That is the kind of machine the human mind is. Maybe this is not a large compliment, but it is all I can afford. Your friend and well-wisher S50. Clemens. To Mrs. H.H. Rogers, in Fairhorn, Mass. Reading, Con, August 12, 1908. Dear Mrs. Rogers, I believe I am the wellest man on the planet today, and good for a trip to Fairhaven, which I discussed with the captain of the New Bedford boat, who pleasantly accosted me in the Grand Central August 5, but the doctor came up from New York day before yesterday, and gave positive orders that I must not stir from here before frost. It is because I was threatened with a swoon 10 or 12 days ago, and went to New York a day or two later, to attend my nephew's funeral, and got horribly exhausted by the heat, and came back here, and had a bilious collapse. In 24 hours I was as sound as a nut again, but nobody believes it but me. This is a prodigiously satisfactory place, and I am so glad I don't have to go back to the turmoil and rush of New York. The house stands high and the horizons are wide, yet the seclusion is perfect. The nearest public road is half a mile away, so there is nobody to look in, and I don't have to wear clothes if I don't want to. I have been downstairs in nightgown and slippers a couple of hours, and have been photographed in that costume, but I will dress now and behave myself. That doctor had half an idea that there is something the matter with my brain. Doctors do know so little, and they do charge so much for it. I wish Henry Rogers would come here, and I wish you would come with him. You can't rest in that crowded place, but you could rest here, for sure. I would learn bridge, and entertain you, and rob you. With love to you both, ever yours, S50. See, in the foregoing letter we get the first intimation of Mark Twain's failing health. The nephew who had died was Samuel E. Moffat, son of Pamela Clemens. Moffat, who was a distinguished journalist and editorial writer on Collier's Weekly, a man beloved by all who knew him, had been drowned in the surf off the Jersey beach. To W. D. Howells, Kittery Point, Maine. August 12, 08. Dear Howells, won't you and Mrs. Howells and Mildred come and give us as many days as you can spare, and examine John's triumph? It is the most satisfactory house I am acquainted with, and the most satisfactorily situated. But it is no place to work in, because one is outside of it all the time, while the sun and the moon are on duty. Outside of it in the loggia, where the breezes blow and the tall arches divide up the scenery and frame it. It's a ghastly long distance to come, and I wouldn't travel such a distance to see anything short of a memorial museum, but if you can't come now you can at least come later, when you return to New York, for the journey will be only an hour and a half per express train. Things are gradually and steadily taking shape inside the house, and nature is taking care of the outside in her ingenious and wonderful fashion, and she is competent, and asks no help and gets none. I have retired from New York for good, I have retired from labor for good, I have dismissed my stenographer, and have entered upon a holiday whose other end is in the cemetery. Yours ever, Mark. From a gentleman in Buffalo, Clemens one day received a letter enclosing an incompleted list of the world's 100 greatest men, men who had exerted the largest visible influence on the life and activities of the race. The writer asked that Mark Twain examine the list and suggest names, adding, "All you include Jesus, as the founder of Christianity, in the list." To the list of statesmen, Clemens added the name of Thomas Paine. To the list of inventors, Edison, and Alexander Graham Bell. The question he answered in detail. To - Buffalo, NY, Private. Reading, Con, August 28, 08. Dear sir, by private, I mean don't print any remarks of mine. I like your list. The artist visible influence. These terms require you to add Jesus. And they doubly and trebly require you to add Satan. From A.D. 352 A.D. 1850 these gentlemen exercised a vaster influence over a fifth part of the human race than was exercised over that fraction of the race by all other influences combined. 90-900ths of this influence proceeded from Satan, the remaining fraction of it from Jesus. During those 1500 years the fear of Satan and hell made 99 Christians, where love of God and heaven landed one. During those 1500 years, Satan's influence was worth very nearly 100 times as much to the business as was the influence of all the rest of the Holy Family put together. You have asked me a question, and I have answered it seriously and sincerely. You have put in Buddha a god, with a following, at one time, greater than Jesus ever had. A god with perhaps a little better evidence of his godship than that which is offered for Jesus's. How then, in fairness, can you leave Jesus out? And if you put him in, how can you logically leave Satan out? Thunder is good, thunder is impressive, but it is the lightning that does the work. Very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. The Children's Theater of the Next Letter was an institution of the New York East Side in which Mark Twain was deeply interested. The children were most, if not all, of Hebrew parentage, and the performances they gave, under the direction of Alice M. Hertz, were really remarkable. It seemed a pity that lack of funds should have brought this excellent educational venture to an untimely end. The following letter was in reply to one enclosing a newspaper clipping reporting a performance of The Prince and the Pauper, given by Chicago schoolchildren. To Mrs. Hookway, in Chicago. September, 1908. Dear Mrs. Hookway, although I am full of the spirit of work this morning, a rarity with me lately, I must steal a moment or two for a word in person. For I have been reading the eloquent account in the Record Herald, and am pleasurably stirred, to my deepest deeps. The reading brings vividly back to me my pet and pride. The Children's Theater of the East Side, New York. And it supports and reaffirms what I have so often and strenuously said in public, that a children's theater is easily the most valuable adjunct that any educational institution for the young can have, and that no otherwise good school is complete without it. It is much the most effective teacher of morals and promoter of good conduct that the ingenuity of man has yet devised, for the reason that its lessons are not taught wearily by book and by dreary homily, but by visible and enthusing action, and they go straight to the heart, which is the rightest of right places for them. Book morals often get no further than the intellect, if they even get that far on their spectral and shadowy pilgrimage. But when they travel from a children's theater they do not stop permanently at that halfway house, but go on home. The children's theater is the only teacher of morals and conduct and high ideals that never bores the pupil, but always leaves him sorry when the lesson is over. And as for history, no other teacher is for a moment comparable to it. No other can make the dead heroes of the world rise up, and shake the dust of the ages from their bones and live and move, and breathe and speak, and be real to the looker and listener. No other can make the study of the lives and times of the illustrious dead a delight, a splendid interest, a passion, and no other can paint a history lesson in colors that will stay, and stay, and never fade. It is my conviction that the children's theater is one of the very, very great inventions of the 20th century, and that its vast educational value now but dimly perceived and, but vaguely understood, will presently come to be recognized. By the article which I have been reading I find the same things happening in the Howland School that we have become familiar with in our children's theater of which I am president, and sufficiently vain of the distinction. These things among others. 1. The educating history study does not stop with the little players, but the whole school catches the infection and revels in it. 2. And it doesn't even stop there. The children carry it home and infect the family with it, even the parents and grandparents. And the whole household fall to studying history and bygone manners and customs and costumes with eager interest. And this interest is carried along to the studying of costumes in old book plates, and beyond that to the selecting of fabrics and the making of clothes. Hundreds of our children learn the plays by listening without book and by making notes. Then the listener goes home and plays the piece, all the parts, to the family. And the family are glad and proud, glad to listen to the explanations and analyses, glad to learn, glad to be lifted to planes above their dreary workaday lives. Our children's theater is educating 7,000 children and their families. When we put on a play of Shakespeare, they fall to studying it diligently, so that they may be qualified to enjoy it to the limit when the piece is staged. 3. Your Howland school children do the construction work, stage-decorations, etc. That is our way to. Our young folks do everything that is needed by the theater with their own hands. Scene designing, scene painting, gas fitting, electric work, costume designing, costume making, everything and all things indeed, and their orchestra and its leader are from their own ranks. The article which I have been reading says, speaking of the historical play produced by the pupils of the Howland School, the question naturally arises, what has this drama done for those who so enthusiastically took part? The touching story has made a year out of the past live for the children as could no chronology or bald statement of historical events. It has cultivated the fancy and given to the imagination strength and purity. Work in composition has ceased to be drudgery, for when all other themes fall flat, a subject dealing with some aspect of the drama presented never fails to arouse interest, and a rapid pushing of pens over paper. That is entirely true. The interest is not confined to the drama story, it spreads out all around the period of the story, and gives to all the outlying and unrelated happenings of that period a fascinating interest, an interest which does not fade out with the years, but remains always fresh, always inspiring, always welcome. History facts dug by the job, with sweat and tears out of a dry and spiritless textbook, but never mind, all who have suffered know what that is. I remain, dear madam, sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.